This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
You name it, we've got it on the programme today. 999 calls, ambulance services, politicians, politics, the future of the BBC, private parking fines, and young people living at home at the hotel of mum and dad. Oh, and we also talk about the 1970s American TV programme, The Waltons. Where else would you get it?
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Let's speak to the chief executive of the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service, Michael Bloomfield. Good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
First things first, what is your message to us all about hitting that number?
Well, my message, as has been said by colleagues over recent days, is if you are seriously unwell, if you are concerned about your health or that of a loved one, do not be put off from phoning 999. You said there are people are worried about what happens when they phone 999. I can tell you when people phone 999, over 90% consistently get that call answered within 5 seconds. Now, that's not obviously reflective of what happens after, but we will answer that call, and our highly skilled staff in our emergency control room will assess that call. They will triage that call. The standard to which they do it is exceptionally high. They have a high level of compliance, and they will assess those patients who are most in need. So if you need, please call, but also be aware of the alternatives. Be aware that when you do call, when you do get through, when we do triage that call, that some patients, particularly those with lower urgency conditions, will wait a very long time in some cases. They will certainly wait much longer than we would like them to do. So therefore, we would ask people to consider when they need to phone that call, are there alternatives that are suitable for them?
I want to put a couple of human stories to you. As you know, some people say they've had a negative experience with 999 call handlers. We'll come to that human side of things in a moment or two if we can. But first of all, numbers. Remind me, Michael, how many crews you have and how many are actually currently tied up waiting outside hospitals?
Well, typically on a day shift, and that's from around 7:30 in the morning to 7:30 at night, the 12-hour shifts, typically we will have anything between around 67 to 70, depending on the day of the week. Day crews, that's across the whole of Northern Ireland. At night, those same hours, but during the nighttime hours, it's anywhere between about 47 and 50. As we speak this morning, so we should be having approximately 70 crews on today. Now, some of those we are not able to get started at 7:30, because if they were delayed at the end of their shift yesterday, they're entitled to what's called compensatory rest. So if they are delayed at an emergency department 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 hours after their shift, they get the compensatory rest this morning. So we won't get up to our full level of capacity until sometime mid-morning. But as we speak now, there are 17 crews waiting outside emergency departments across Northern Ireland. So that's 17 out of a full complement of 70, but we won't have all 70 started at this stage of the day.
Michael, I know you don't like talking about individual cases, and there might be only so much you can say after I play this to you, but you maybe heard on the BBC last week Isabel Benson talking about her experience after calling 999. Her son was ill. Her son Brian was in significant pain, and she says she was told to give him painkillers. Have a listen to what she says happens next.
He just collapsed at the doors, and the security came out, and then all the other staff came out, and they cut his shirt up, and they started to give him CPR because his heart had stopped. And the consultant had told me in A&E, if you hadn't have got down there when you did and took the action that you took, we would be dealing with a corpse now. Absolutely shocking. It is so upsetting. Never in this day, like in this modern age, like, you know, would have I ever envisioned having to do that? I know the NHS is bad and the pressures, and I totally get that and understand that. But never would have thought, you know, given his history and all the information to hand, that they were you know, that they were in possession of on that phone call. They didn't deem him an emergency, and they could have very well cost him his life.
Michael Bloomfield, have you any response to that? Is there anything you can say? I know you don't like talking about individual cases.
Well, I won't talk about the individual case that Mrs. Benson raised in relation to her son, but, you know, obviously, Mark, listening to that as anybody would, it is appalling. Nobody should find themselves in that situation. I deeply regret it, and I apologise sincerely to Mrs. Benson and to Brian. And as we said last week, we would be very willing to meet with them to discuss the case. But what I can say, Mark, it highlights the incredibly long response times that we are facing and the decisions that we are sometimes asking individuals and families to make, and indeed the decisions that the staff in our control room and the judgments they are having to make as to is it appropriate to ask somebody to make their way to hospital. So without getting into that particular case, we triage calls into five categories. The main ones, category one, are immediately life-threatening, and that's an eight-minute target. Now, I know Mrs. Benson said about not, you know, surprising that the call was not urgent. We've got to be careful on the terminology. Category one, immediately life-threatening, means a patient is not breathing or conscious, and no matter what, we divert any other calls to respond to those. They're a relatively small number, about 7% of calls. The largest category are category two. Those are still urgent calls. Those are seriously ill patients, things like suspect heart attack and suspect stroke. We should be responding to an average of those within 18 minutes. In this year to date, from the start of January until yesterday, our average response time for those is 99.0 minutes, an hour and a half. That's actually improved from the first week, believe it or not, of January, when it was 116 minutes, nearly 2 hours. That is the average. Clearly, there will be people who are waiting much longer. Those are the ones that worry me most. Seriously, seriously ill patients who we should get to in 18 minutes, and there's a clinical reason why it's 18 minutes, and we are taking, on average, an hour and a half, and sometimes I know that those calls are taking 5, 6, 7 hours, and that is unacceptable, and it brings a very high level of risk. And in those cases, it's a judgment call between the clinicians in our control room and families as to whether they are better trying to make their own way to hospital where they can get definitive care or wait. And what it does sound, without me saying anything more, it does sound in Mrs. Benson's case, and for her son, it is as well she made that call and got him to hospital.
Well, thank you for fronting up. One more human story, which is aimed at the bigger picture rather than the ambulance service. So I think it's worth hearing it. Mary Donaghy was cut out of her car last week after a crash. She was brought to the Royal Victoria Hospital's emergency department in an ambulance, but due to the lack of beds, she was left to wait for hours outside the hospital, still in the ambulance. Now, my colleague Mary-Louise Connolly, the BBC's health correspondent here in Northern Ireland, was there, and she spoke to Mary's sister, Sharon.
She's freezing. She's absolutely freezing in there. They keep turning the heating on to try and help her. They've given her morphine there to try and help with the pain because she's in so much pain. But it's just frustrating. The health service is on its knees at the minute. It's not the nurses. It's not the doctor's fault. It's not the paramedics. I mean, they've been fantastic where they're there. The government need to do something at the end of the day. They need to put care packages in place for the amount of patients who are sitting in those wards with nowhere to go at the minute. You know, what's happening? What are they doing?
Hope Mary's okay and she's got the treatment that she needs and she's now on the mend. But it's the big picture that Sharon was talking about there, Michael Bloomfield. What is the plan to stop this happening again and again and again?
Well, if I could briefly just say first, Mark, and again, apologies to Mary for that, which can only be a dreadful wait in the back of an ambulance in the weather that we've seen over the last few weeks.
In fairness, that's not the ambulance service's fault.
No, and I listened to the debate in the Assembly yesterday and that was consistently recognised. But what I do need to say is, sadly, that is not an unusual every single day there are people waiting in the back of the ambulance, that sort of length of time. As we sit here now, of those 17 patients that are waiting outside emergency departments, there are patients who have been waiting longer than 7 hours. And we're losing an awful lot of capacity. In the month of November, we lost 29% of our overall capacity over the month. It's typically 25%, but in November it was 29%. That has a direct impact on our response times. In terms of the bigger picture and what needs to be done,
yeah.
This has been commented on a lot over the last week on all of the very many programmes that I've watched and listened to, including broadcast by the BBC, and it is the priority on being able to get flow through hospital system, get those who need it into hospital quickly, get them flow through the hospital system, and when their treatment in a hospital has come to an end, that they're able to be discharged quickly. You've heard most days over the last 10 days that there's over 500 people every single day in hospital who are what we call medically fit, who are ready to leave hospital. That is consistently more than the number of people who are in emergency departments waiting for a bed. So at one level, it would think, well, if we can sort out the back door, that sorts out the front door. And to a large extent, that would be the case. But sorting out the back door is not an easy issue. It requires the social care to be built up, to be able to get people quickly discharged, a lot of them to their own home with domiciliary care packages. The other benefit of increasing that social care is, as well as getting people out of hospital quickly, it's actually being able to keep many more people in their own homes and not needing to go to hospital in the first place.
Michael.
We're bringing people out of their homes, out of care homes where they have a bed, to spend hours in an ambulance and days in a hospital. We need to focus on increasing social care capacity to prevent that.
You're on the inside. I was looking at your CV. You've been within the health service per se for more than 25 years. I think you started in the Department of Health in 1998, the year of the Good Friday Agreement. It's that long ago. You've been a civil servant for more than 30 years. I think we're roughly the same age. We may have even gone to the same school. Michael, come on.
We did.
I think you were slightly below me anyway.
Always.
So, that's very kind. You're still going to get a hard question. I mean, the time for talking's over. Can you tell us, in your extensive experience, what needs to happen?
You've heard again a lot over the last number of days that it's not only about money, but investment is important. So it needs both investment and transformation. We cannot keep putting more and more money into doing things the same way, trying to meet this endless demand. The demand will rise faster than we can fund it or get the workforce. But money is important. At the same time, we need to do things differently, what's often referred to as transformation. There is a lot of transformation taking place in the health service. Within my own service, in the ambulance service, we are now in our control room dealing with about 10% of the calls without sending an ambulance. This time last year, that was only 4%. That's easing pressures on the system. That is good for patients. We need to have similar sort of initiatives right across health and social care, which there are, largely about trying to find ways to support people in their local community and at home. Initiatives like Hospital at Home that have been talked about a lot over the last number of weeks. But also we need investment. It does cost money to transform, certainly until alternatives are up and running and start to ease the pressures on the hospital system. So it does cost money to do that, and it certainly needs additional funding than we currently have available, even to keep the system in stability. We're talking here only about urgent and emergency care. You think of all the other areas under pressure: cancer, elective waiting lists, mental health. So there is a significant funding issue, but we've really got to accelerate how we do things differently, with a particular focus on trying to keep people in communities, support them at home through primary care and community care, working in partnership with the hospital system.
I was interested to hear that you were listening to that Stormont debate yesterday. Anything catch your ear, catch your eye that you could work on?
I welcomed the recognition from many of the members who spoke that this is not an ambulance service issue or problem per se, that it is a wider system. Also, the minister recognised these issues are UK-wide, and in fact, I was on a meeting yesterday with the chief executives of all of the UK ambulance services, and they've seen very similar patterns and pressures that we have over the last 2 weeks. So these are not easy issues
No.
that can be quickly addressed. But what did strike me and welcomed is there is unanimous support. I believe there's that unanimous support right across all parties, and certainly those Assembly members who spoke about the need for change, about a recognition that we cannot keep doing things the way we are doing it. And I'm hopeful that as we move forward and bring forward proposals for transformation, that that will bring and lead to an increasing support to introduce those change, because it's fair to say that to date that support is not always forthcoming. Sometimes there is support in principle, but whenever it gets down to the specifics, there is not that support, and we continue to see that. I'm encouraged that there's a recognition that we cannot keep carrying on, and therefore there'll be more support for those changes.
The Alliance Party's health spokesperson, Danny Donnelly, put out a statement yesterday, some facts and figures in here. He says, in the most recent complete statistics, ambulance response times for all categories of call-outs were missed in every month of the year. Meanwhile, in the current financial year, calls for life-threatening injuries are almost 50% behind their target. This isn't just a winter problem.
No, absolutely not, Mark. I think the term winter pressures really is a misnomer. It's one I think we should really leave behind. There are particular seasonal problems that come with increased respiratory illness, etc., which does lead to an increased number of particularly frail elderly people going to hospital. But these pressures are right across the year. We've seen these pressures. Our response times have been at the same sort of levels really from the end of the summer. And I did hear Danny say that, and I suppose whenever I'm telling you that the mean response for something that should be 18 minutes is an hour and a half, it's really not a surprise that they're not being achieved in any month, and sadly that is the case.
Michael, what about your own staff? I mean, I'd hate to have their job. My job is so much easier than them, than making what can be a life and death decision when you're answering that phone. How are they? How are your own staff?
Well, firstly, they are remarkable. Mark and I pay tribute to them, as indeed to staff right across health and social care, people right across the system. You know, we keep saying it. They're exhausted. They're working at incredible levels, and we just cannot keep relying on that goodwill. So they are incredible for what they do every day, and the fact that they keep on doing it. But they are hugely frustrated, and whether that's the staff in our call room taking those 999 calls who see names on a list who need an ambulance when they come on shift, who are perhaps still there when they leave shift, and they have not been able to allocate an ambulance to them. That brings huge distress to those staff in control, in our control room. To those staff out operationally responding to calls, this is the single biggest issue that when I meet with staff, they consistently raise. It frustrates them on so many levels. Professionally, they are not using the skills that they have that are there to save lives. They are not using those to best effect when they spend, in some cases, most if not all of their shift waiting with a patient in an ambulance. There is potentially a skill fade as a result of that. Similarly with new staff, we have recently recruited 48 new paramedics, and they started out operationally just before Christmas. In years gone by, those paramedics would have dealt with anywhere between 6 and 8 calls in a shift, seeing a wide range of conditions and circumstances. If they're only going to 1 or 2 calls, which is now the norm, clearly they're not getting that same exposure. It also makes it very difficult for us to get our staff their rest period during a long 12-hour shift, and it is not unheard of for staff not to get a rest period at all, or certainly not until maybe the 9th or the 10th hour. And then that issue, which is a very significant issue for our staff, that they cannot be sure that they will get home at the end of a long 12-hour shift. They may not get away for on to 13, 14, 15 hours, then have to drive an ambulance back to station to do various tasks then, which must be done, and then drive home. Now, I'm very aware of the risk that goes with that, yeah. But that also impacts on people's family lives. Nobody should not know when they go into work with some level of certainty what time they will get home, and that brings huge pressure to them as well.
Yeah, never mind what they've gone through during their working day. I know some of them may be listening. Thank you for all that you're doing. Michael, can you bear with us for 1 minute? I just want to bring in Danny Donnelly. We didn't bring you on to sort of go head to head, but I just want a quick word from Danny Donnelly, the Alliance Health spokesperson. Then I'll give you the final word, Michael Bloomfield. Danny Donnelly, when you listen to Michael Bloomfield and you see the challenges, whether they be physical, financial, emotional, do you not have a bit more sympathy for him now and all of his colleagues?
We always did have sympathy for Michael, and I'm very, very clear that this is not in any way directed at the ambulance service. Our motion yesterday was about improving capacity within the ambulance service and for the Health Minister to bring forward plans to do that. I know the incredible strain that the health service is under, and in particularly the ambulance service reflected in our motion yesterday. You know, we have visited ambulance service headquarters. We've met with paramedics. We've had Michael at committee explaining the pressures and explaining the problems with flow, why the ambulances were outside, A&Es for such prolonged periods, and why the staff had to sit with patients for sometimes more than one shift.
Yeah.
So this is absolutely not directed at the ambulance service.
So what are you saying?
They're doing a fantastic job. I think they're doing a fantastic job, and I would absolutely commend the ambulance service for their efforts to keep people safe and well, particularly over this really, really tense time when pressures are so high. Our motion yesterday was very clear. We were asking the Health Minister to urgently bring forward proposals to improve the availability and capacity of the ambulance service, including a development workforce plan for them. Now, the Minister did agree to that. He said that his officials are now working with the ambulance service on a 10-year workforce plan. One of the things that we've heard about again and again and again about ambulance capacity is the capacity that is lost. And Michael referred to it there quite a few times now, that typically 25% of ambulance capacity is lost because of ambulances sitting outside our A&E departments. That is a huge failure. You know, we need to fix that. And that is not on the ambulance service. That is a failure of flow. So the flow within the hospital means that the patients cannot be brought into an emergency department when they need to be seen.
How do you fix that, Danny?
Well, we know where the bottleneck is. The bottleneck is at the back door. So we need to widen the bottleneck. And that means, as Michael referred to, building up capacity within social care. So we need domiciliary care packages. We need places for patients to go safely, to be safely discharged when they are medically fit for discharge. So as has been heard again and again over several reports in the BBC, we sometimes have 500 patients lying in hospital beds who are medically fit for discharge.
Sure.
They do not need to be there while we have similar numbers.
Sorry to interrupt, Danny Donnelly, but that needs more money. And did Alliance not object to the health service getting more money during one of the monitoring rounds last year?
The Alliance Party supported the budget, that the Health Minister got. What we are asking the Health Minister for now is to realise that we are in a crisis. Healthcare professionals have said time and time again over the last couple of weeks, we are at breaking point. You know, we need to step up. There is a crisis here. So what we are saying to the Health Minister, and this was in our motion yesterday, that there is a crisis. He needs to urgently bring forward proposals to improve the availability and capacity of the ambulance services.
Final word to you, Michael Bloomfield. We appreciate your time. We know just how busy you are. As I said, this isn't your first winter health crisis. Is there anything in your experience that suggests that this time, it's going to be a turning point and things will change?
Well, I think, Mark, there is, and I do welcome the debate coming yesterday, and as I think Danny said in his winding up remarks, for it to be the first debate on to the Assembly in 2025, I do welcome, because it keeps a focus on this very important issue. But I think that also shows determination. I think what I heard yesterday is determination. I certainly heard from the Health Minister determination. I know he has said about his intention to hold an event early this year, towards the end of February, early March, what he referred to as a blank page event, where we really do look at what can be done differently, and we have to be realistic about what can be done differently in the financial environment and in the timescale. But I believe there is a determination that gets greater each year, as we do see the point, and clinicians increasingly saying it, and elected representatives saying it, that we cannot carry on, given that there is unanimous agreement that the issue we must focus on as a priority is that backdoor issue that Danny referred to, the bottleneck, being able to discharge people to keep them in community through social care. I believe that if our collective efforts are focused on that early in the year, we can make some improvement on that for next year. I need to be realistic. And do I see this massively turning around in a year? No, I don't, because I think there is too much needs to be done, and there's too much investment required. But I do think with that collective focus on the one area that we see as the most significant problem, that we should be able to make an improvement on it for this time next year, in particularly for those frail and particularly elderly in our community, who frankly, having them waiting for maybe 6 hours for an ambulance, then waiting maybe at least the same in an ambulance, and then waiting days in an emergency department, is not a way that our frail elderly, not an experience our frail elderly should have, including for those who that's perhaps in the last weeks and months of their lives.
Michael Bloomfield, Chief Executive of the Northern Ireland Ambulance Service, thank you. We'll let you go. You're busy. Danny Donnelly's busy as well. But Danny, I want you to stay on. We'll have more from you and from our callers. You've been calling in on this. You've been calling in on living at home. You've been calling in on private parking fines. You've been calling in on the future of the BBC as well. We're going to talk to former Strictly Come Dancing contestant Edwina Curry. I think she was also a former Conservative MP. We're going to be talking to her about that too. But we're sticking with health. Stay with us. Let's go to Enniskillen. First caller of the day. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning again, Mark, from a, I would say, a semi-sunny Fernand. How are you?
All good. I'm told it's mild, even in Fermanagh. What about the situation within the health service? What's your take on it? What's the solution, Brian? Let's get solution-focused.
Well, I think we have the equivalent of an emergency earthquake scenario here, with the level of destruction of our healthcare service, and starting with the ambulances. So I think we need immediate planning, which should have already been in place, for the army to come in. I think I'm quoting Mike Nesbitt, and I apologise if I've got him wrong, when he mentioned that he wasn't considering army roaming the corridors of hospitals. Well, with the problems, for example, the ambulance crews who cannot relieve their patients and move on for another call, I would be managing the army in a different way than Mr. Mike would have been. They would be aggressively put into the hospitals to relieve some of the pressure from the ambulance crews. I would also have them, on a permanent basis within A&E. And I would also set up a hub for transportation of ambulance crew back to bases, or even back to their homes if their shifts overlap, to give them a rest period, that the rest period would not cost potentially people to either get sicker or extra lives lost, which is actually the truth of what's happening here. And I would also suggest that we need to aggressively head towards Poland, because our qualifications in healthcare are exactly the same as here on qualification date, for aggressive recruitment of staff from that particular area of the planet. And last but not least, are you ready for this one? Since Brexit has come in, GPs that would have worked in the South West Acute Hospital and other medical staff cannot legally work here, since Brexit has took place, which they did the day before it, and they can't for some reasons because their qualifications aren't recognised. There's a list, and I guarantee you, for between now and Timbuktu, you'll never hear somebody like Mike Nesbitt approach the situation the way a business person like myself has just done. And that would relieve and save lives immediately. And I've run this past with clients of mine that are high up in healthcare, and they've actually sat back and said, you do a great job with what you do, but by God, we could do with you in healthcare. So there's a way to relieve staff and get them home safe and respect our staff by bringing in the army. We have sent troops abroad.
Okay.
We've sent troops abroad to help out with earthquake disasters, etc., in their droves. Now we need the troops here. That's the bottom line, to sort of help alleviate. It's not a full-time solution, but it alleviates potentially. If it only saves a half a dozen lives, it's worth it. There you go.
Brian, a man with a plan. Danny Donnelly, let's get some immediate political reaction from the Alliance Party to Brian's plan.
I think we have to look at all options. Now, what we were asking was the Health Minister to bring forward urgent proposals. We haven't seen any of those yet. And certainly Mike had responded in Health Committee last week to the call for bringing the army in. And he had said at the time that it wasn't something that was on his radar. It wasn't something that he was planning to do. There is certainly a crisis. We are in a healthcare crisis. Healthcare professionals have been saying that for weeks and weeks. There doesn't seem to be anything that's going to make a significant impact on that crisis on the horizon at the minute. So again, we have to look at all options, and I'm waiting to hear what the Health Minister is going to bring forward as an urgent proposal.
Danny, remind us of your own healthcare background. What is it you do?
My background is in nursing. I've been a nurse in a hospital in Northern Ireland for 15, 16 years.
Take off your political hat, put on your nurse's uniform. How would you feel about a squaddy, a soldier, a member of the military helping you do your job?
I have no problem at all with that. I appreciate there may be issues in a Northern Ireland context with that, but certainly during COVID, we had the Army who were coming in to do a very specific job, and the very specific job was to deliver vaccination clinics. So they have helped before. We're very conscious onwards when we are short-staffed that, you know, there is work that needs done, and certainly I know a lot of nurses that do above and beyond and stay on extra hours and work through their tea breaks and come in their days off and to get work done so that they know that colleagues aren't going to be impacted. I think people would appreciate help from wherever it comes from, but the minister has to bring forward proposals. It is up to him to step up with proposals to say how to alleviate this crisis.
And he doesn't like this one, Danny. Looking back to what he said, was this at the beginning of last week? I think it was, because we floated this idea because it was said to Mary Louise Connolly from people within the health service that they felt it was worth considering bringing in the army. Mike Nesbitt, I think the next day, so that's probably Tuesday of last week, exactly a week ago, he said, I think when they, the army, were here for COVID, their use was in offering vaccines and in physically moving people around within the hospital campus. And that's not what we need for this. So I don't see that as an option. But back to you, Brian. I think that's what you were suggesting, you know, that even if it's just driving a few vehicles around, something would be better than nothing, Brian.
Well, for example, Mike Nesbitt's response to me just shows complete and utter lack of understanding of the situation, a form of incompetence, because he's historically talking about an example related to COVID. I'm talking about a pre-plan which Mike should have had in place where the army would be used not just to do what they did in the past. That was a different task. This is an emergency crisis that, for example, as the Alliance guy has just said, staff doing extra hours after their shifts. Staff having to drive. For example, a lorry driver wouldn't be legally allowed to do that.
No. I wonder.
Could you just say, Mark, briefly, I am sick and tired in Northern Ireland of politicians with the blinkers on as if they're running a Grand National and they can't jump a fence. This is a crisis. We have a solution to relieve staff from possibly driving over the ditch going home or making mistakes on the wards, and no disrespect intended. So let's get on with it. And Mike Nesbitt, if you're not fit for it, swallow your tablet and move aside.
Well, I'm not sure that's fair, Brian. You know Mike Nesbitt. I think we all know Mike Nesbitt because he's been around such a long time, whether it be as a TV presenter or as an MLA, a party leader, and now a minister. Let me finish if you can, Brian.
Sorry.
Why wouldn't he? Why wouldn't he? If he felt this would help, why wouldn't he do it? He obviously has his reasons. There's a chance he may come onto the programme before the end of the week, so we look forward to that. Back to you, Danny Donnelly. I mean, you hinted at it. Could it be this Northern Ireland thing where everybody isn't exactly in favour of the British Army?
Well, may well be a factor, and you know there's long historical reasons for that. But as I said, the Army have been here before. They did help out during COVID, and certainly we were very grateful for that. But certainly what we're asking the Minister is to look at all available options. We need urgent action. You know, when you're hearing that you're in a crisis, you're hearing that you're at breaking point, and you need to take action. So he needs to review all possible options and put forward some proposals to help.
Well, we've got a concrete proposal from our phone lines already from Brian in Inniskillen. What about South Down? Gareth in Kirkcubbon. Good morning, Gareth. Have you any ideas?
Good morning, Mark. Well, a lot of us are quite puzzled, really, because we're supposed to have a more integrated health and social care system like Scotland. We don't have quite as much money for that as they do, but we certainly do have more money than the, you know, than England for it. So, therefore, you know, why isn't it flowing better at the discharge end? You know, do we actually need to have not only ambulance stations, but social care hubs or social care stations that process these people without prejudice to whether the providers are public or private? Because last week we had a representative on from the private care sector saying that there was 1,100 places available both in social care and in domiciliary care, okay, but it wasn't being processed for those places to be used. And again, comparing us to England, maybe even, God forbid, we actually need to start to involve our councils in the management of social care to make sure that these places do actually get used, Mark.
Well, I think somebody made the point at Stormont yesterday, be careful what you wish for, because we currently have a joined up system whereby within the Health and Social Care Trust, the front door talks to the back door. If you bring in the councils, you're lacking that joined up system.
But where is the blockage then? I mean, we've been through it all the last couple of weeks. It really hit me whenever Deirdre Heaton said that we spend 52% on health. We already know we can't spend a higher percentage on health. I also discussed with you the actual nature of the wards in the hospital, in the hospitals, including the newly built one, once. And we established that obviously we can't just magically build extra rooms. We can't just create extra capacity in wards overnight. So we've dealt with all those different factors. So where is the blockage? Where is the blockage? And why aren't those managers? It's going to come down to the managers. It goes round in cycles. I can remember about 20 years ago, I can remember slightly more than 20 years ago, everybody was blaming the junior doctors. And then after that, they all started to blame the managers. It was the managers that were getting all the stick. So maybe now is the time to actually put the pressure back on the managers.
Interesting.
We have the money. We're supposed to have a better flow here. We have extra capacity in the private sector for domiciliary care and for social care. Why aren't these people being cared for very, very well in the hospitals and also being sent on to where they need to go to next so that there isn't such congestion at the start of it, Mark?
We get it. We get it. We get it. Gareth, thank you. Danny Donnelly, last word quickly if you can.
I think that's a fair point. We do have an integrated health and social care system here. You know, the front door should talk to the back door and that should make it easier. So we would hope that having that joined up system should make patient flow a lot easier. But we clearly have a problem. There is a bottleneck. We need to address the bottleneck and the Minister needs to address that urgently.
Danny Donnelly, thank you. Thank you to Gareth. Thank you to Brian. Thank you to Michael Bloomfield as well. It's a quarter to ten. Oh, Big Brother, you can't get away from Big Brother or those CCTV cameras. Whether it's number plate recognition, software systems or even human beings watching everything that we do. Yesterday we heard how Belfast City Airport are now employing a company to fine people if they drop off outside their official parking zones. But what are our rights when private companies slap a parking ticket onto our windscreen or send it through the post? Well, whether it's a supermarket car park or a beach car park, do you have to pay Even though, if you look at the small print, some of these private companies that have been delegated to issue with the fines are actually in England. Do they have jurisdiction here? Do we have to pay? We'll ask a lawyer in a moment. But first of all, have a listen to Donald, who was on the show yesterday.
I was caught twice last month there, coming up to Christmas.
Oh, Donald.
£200 fines. It shows you playing. They've sent me the readout of it, and it shows you on the wee roundabout, as you know, as you're saying there, when you go, in, go on the, up over the underpass.
Yes.
At that wee roundabout, Michael, he used to stand. I've lived in there 10 years, and lately I never even noticed it. But anyway, in the last coming to Christmas there, he was over twice, and they got me the twice, and he was standing waiting with his bag. He threw it in the back of the car, into the car and away. It wasn't 30 seconds, £100.
Well, that was an expensive pickup, Donald.
Not me, I'm not paying. Sure, they'll feed me in the tumbler up in McGarra or somewhere. Sure, I wouldn't pay that for 30 seconds.
You're not paying it.
No, well, not paying. Not a chance of paying.
Well, we'll check out whether you're breaking the law or not, Donald.
I'm not breaking the law. Sure, they can't come here to lift it. I was always told Northern Ireland, them English crowd can't come over here.
But rules are rules. You were on their property. Do you not have a moral obligation, even if you don't have a legal obligation, to pay your fine?
So if your car broke down or something, you're going to get done for £100. What happens there in a case of that?
Your car didn't break down, Donald, unless you're going to claim that now.
No, I'm not. But I'm sure not paying it, I'll tell you. £100 for 3 seconds. I've heard of rip-offs. That's a big one.
What are you saying to Belfast City Airport this morning? Now you know the rules. Are you going to obey the rules?
I never was on the planes and I've never been again in my life. I don't care how they can walk out. They can walk the Belfast as they want. Never through the gate again.
Ouch. Well, we're going to get Donald some free legal advice in a moment. First of all, I need to say, that was all about Belfast City Airport, and they insist that these new rules, which have been in place now for a couple of months now, they are needed to protect the safety of pedestrians, motorists and staff. If you want to drop off at Belfast City Airport, there are safe places to do that. The airport say you can go into one of their car parks and pay £3 for a quick park and pick up your passenger, or you can even park for free for 10 minutes in the long stay. So, do you have to pay these private parking companies? Let's ask the solicitor, Tony Cahir. Good morning.
Good morning, Mark.
Yay or nay, do we have to pay?
Well, you should pay. And if Donald chooses not to pay, but he ever goes back into the airport with a number of outstanding fines unpaid, there's always a remedy of clamping. Clamping is still legal in Northern Ireland. And while some people might think, well, I don't have anything, they can't recover money from me, there's nothing worse than coming back from somewhere and finding your vehicle clamped and having to pay £125 to have it unclamped. But if the private car park company or the company retained by the owners of the car park choose to proceed against you, they have to prove that you were the driver. It's not sufficient for them to write to the keeper and indicate that the keeper is obliged to tell them who was driving on the day in question. It's the duty falls upon the private company to prove who was the driver. And that's extremely difficult, as you can may imagine, in a number of situations. And secondly, if you choose not to pay, well, the option that they have here is to bring you to the small claims court and to proceed against you to obtain a judgment through the small claims court. And if unenforced, then that can have an impact on your credit rating. It can have consequences for you.
Donald was saying there, I think slightly tongue-in-cheek, you know, he'll go to McGabry prison if he has to. I take it he couldn't be jailed.
No, this is a contract. This isn't people. And in fact, I noticed even in the press release from Belfast City Airport, they talked about penalties and people talk about fines. They're not. They're a claim for damages for breach of contract. There's an implied term when you go into the property of whether it be an airport or a railway station, that you're entering into an implied contract to pay a parking charge or not to park in a part of their facility that might impede other traffic. And one can imagine, even if it is only a 30-second stop, if more vehicles than Donald's chose to park there, it could impede vehicles that might require to enter onto the premises in an emergency. And one can understand why it is necessary to extend the parking charge regime right to the gates, right to the entrance of the airport in question.
So to be clear, free legal advice on the BBC Radio Ulster airwaves, your advice to Donald is, Donald, suck it up and pay it.
Well, yes, I am saying that. But if Donald chooses not to do it, then the company has to prove that he was driving on the day in question. Now, I think he's come on the radio and told
that
he was.
Yes, but we'll get that off BBC Sounds, Donald, honestly. Delete.
Got the free legal advice before he chose to do that.
Yes.
But he's now indicated that he was the driver.
Yes.
But many people, and you know, over the years, I have spoken to a number of clients who have indicated, and I say, well, they have to first of all prove that it was you. But if they manage to do that, there are consequences. You lose your right of appeal. The charges increase. And you can end up then being brought to the small claims court. But he's right to say that most of these recovery companies are English-based and they don't have facilities in Northern Ireland. And, you know, it is a hassly thing to bring claims to the small claims court. It's an expensive thing because you cannot recover legal costs. In so doing, all you can recover is the stamp duty payable to the court. And I think in many, many cases, they choose not to bring such proceedings. But if someone is a persistent offender, for example, goes to the supermarket every day, parks in the supermarket and goes off to work or goes off and has lunch and breaches the usual two-hour time limit, then the company in question can clamp that vehicle. And as I say, having been a victim of a clamping in another jurisdiction, there's nothing worse than coming back to your car in a hurry and finding it clamped. You may wait hours to get it unclamped and you pay a fee of £125 in this jurisdiction.
Remind us of the different rules within the UK on clamping, Tony. I know is it too soon?
No, it's here. You can't do that. I mean,
I'm talking about what happened to you.
Well, it's still raw, but it was in Dublin. And, you know, a lot of Dublin streets have private parking facilities in the streets, so the residents pay that. And if you park in one of those zones, then the clamping companies scour the district and will clamp you. And then a different individual comes back hours later, you having paid the 125 remotely on the machine, but it may be 2 hours, maybe 3 hours before they come, and you're sitting maybe freezing in a car waiting for the clamping company to reappear. So that's, and if you damage the clamp, then that may amount to a criminal offence, and that can be even more serious matter. So these are serious matters, but they're not fines in private car parks. They're not penalties. They are breach of contract damages. And the Court of Appeal, the Supreme Court in England 9 years ago indicated that sums of £85, £100 are quite reasonable. They're not disproportionate. They're not exorbitant. And they therefore are recoverable if they pitch them at that level. If you were asked to pay a fee of £250 to £500, then I believe a court would say that's disproportionate. And that is a penalty clause. And penalty clauses are unlawful in contracts, civil contracts.
And did you say it's legal to clamp here in Northern Ireland, but not in other parts of the UK? Excuse me.
I'm not sure about other parts of the UK, but it's still lawful to clamp here. And as I say, the companies may clamp your vehicle if there are a number of outstanding notices that you have not paid. So I hope it doesn't happen, but if Donald ever chose to go back to the airport, he says he won't, but if he ever did, there's always a theoretical possibility that he could be clamped.
And just to recap, finally, Tony, you're saying it's too late for poor little Donald, but you're saying that if you do get one of these penalty notices, if you're the person who's been dropped off, it's not on you, it's whoever has been driving the car.
Correct. It's the driver. And even though you may own the car, but it may be your spouse or children or friend, if they're on the insurance policy, driving the car. But it's not up to you to clarify who was driving. You're under no onus to tell the company who was driving the car on the date in question. The company must establish who was driving the car on the date in question. The only information they can get from DVLA is who is the registered keeper. And the registered keeper quite often is not the driver of the vehicle on the date in question.
I'm stretching your goodwill here in terms of free legal advice. You're very generous with your time. So if you get that penalty notice because the car is in your name and maybe your other half has been driving and you know it wasn't you that was driving, you were just being let off, like for argument's sake. Say, my wife dropped me off. Not that I would ever do that in an illegal zone at Belfast City Airport, but I get the letter through the post. What should I do?
You may ignore it. because it's a person of a different gender even driving the car. So that would be clearly wrong. And what would they do? The ultimate sanction for them would be to bring a case against you in the small claims court, which you could obviously successfully defend and say, I wasn't driving that car. Here's my wife's coming to tell you that she was the driver on the date in question. So no legal obligation, moral obligation on you to tell the company who was driving the car. There's a statute in England that indicates it is the keeper's responsibility. That's the Protection of Freedom Act, for some reason. That's the title given to it. That does not apply in Northern Ireland.
Well, Tony, thanks for coming on. Before you go, were you surprised to get our call? Are you getting more and more calls from clients about this or not?
This is a regular thing. But this is obviously an innovation that Belfast City Airport has extended the notices to the very gates of the premises. But it's understandable why they're doing that. And I think this arose because somebody said they didn't see the notices. Well, the notices are there. And I think on the social media and various news platforms, you see the notices clearly indicating that you may be required to pay up to £100 if you drop off or pick up in a zone that's not a dedicated parking zone within the premises.
And Tony, finally, Donald will be listening. Tell Donald what you think he should do.
Well, they may come after Donald. Donald has indicated, that he hasn't got it and he doesn't intend to pay it. And he seemed quite definite in those views. And I don't think I'm going to dissuade him. And I think it's unlikely that they will ever proceed against Donald. But Donald should be careful that he does not persist in that conduct because he may be clamped.
Tony, thank you very much indeed. Thank you for all your calls on this. Keep them coming. We want to keep at this. During this week on The Nolan Show, I'm here all week, as they say, folks. I'm really interested. Have you got one of these penalty notices from Belfast City Airport? Are you going to pay? What are you going to do now that we've got some legal advice? I know there are some car parks in North Down where people have had penalty notices as well. I know there are some supermarkets in Greater Belfast where people have got these fines or penalty notices. Now you've heard the legal advice straight from the horse's mouth, metaphorically speaking. Don't sue me, Tony. What are you going to do next? The Culture Secretary, Lisa Nandy, has been thinking about this. She's reported to be exploring plans to scrap the licence fee and instead fund us here at the BBC through general taxation. The Sunday Times reported at the weekend that this change could happen as soon as the end of the BBC's current charter in 2027. That's only, what, just over 2 years away. Now, the licence fee, I don't need to tell you if you pay it, is currently £169.50 from April. That's going to rise to £174.50, an extra fiver. So, is it worth it? Is it time for change? Let's talk about this now with the Belfast Telegraph commentator Malachy O'Doherty and the former Conservative MP Edwina Curry. Good morning to you both.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, Edwina.
Edwina, I was looking back in the BBC archives. You're a former employee here. You appeared in Strictly Come Dancing in 2011. So you don't come at this totally unbiased.
Oh, that's absolutely right. Also, you may remember I was a presenter on Five Live for a number of years. Yes, that's right. I think what Lisa Nandy's trying to do is solve the wrong problem in the wrong way. She is concerned about the cost to the taxpayer of having to chase people who don't pay the licence fee, which is quite a substantial sum of money in its own right. And she thinks the way to do that is to lump the whole lot onto the taxpayer instead. And both of those are a mistake. The days, I think, when the BBC could be funded in the way that it is are coming to an end. It's no longer the sole source of information or entertainment as it was back in the 1930s, 100 years ago. We have streaming, we have subscription, we have an awful lot of free news out there funded by advertising. And I think the BBC itself needs to be thinking very, very hard about how it's going to survive into the future without the help of the government.
Malachy, what do you think?
Well, I mean, there's fair points there. I understand that. I mean, there is a kind of free market in news and entertainment that is much wider than it was. The question for me is whether it is worthwhile preserving something like public service broadcasting. And I do think it is. I think the danger with the you know, the expansion of streaming and other channels and social media and so on, is that we lose a sense of authority. We lose a sense that here is a broadcaster that is dependable and that is not, you know, carried by the winds of change and going with every little rumor or prejudice or conspiracy theory all over the place. So I want that. I don't know how to get that exactly, because obviously the BBC is flawed, as every human institution is flawed. But I do think that fundamentally we should be aspiring to the creation of a rock-solid public service broadcaster, and that we need that, except that we need that for the proper functioning of a democracy, because the functioning of a democracy depends on a well-informed voter, a well-informed electorate. The other side of it that I think is good about the idea of transferring it to taxation is that it removes that whole problem of people going to jail for not paying their licence fee, which is appalling and which is a huge embarrassment for the BBC and shouldn't be happening. So you take it away from the licence, you put it in taxation in some way, then you stop all these people going to jail. Well, and that's a good thing.
That's a big issue for some people. Others say, well, it just happens to be the law. Edwina, you mentioned the fact that you used to present on Five Live. Did that change your perspective of the BBC?
No, not really. I take on board what Malachy is saying about public interest broadcasting. But that does not have to be done through taxation or a licence fee. I mean, it's done through public broadcasting in America, and they don't have either of those. Channel 4 is also a public service broadcaster, and it's not funded by a licence fee. It can be done, and it can be done particularly when it comes to news. But there is really no reason why something like Strictly Come Dancing, for example, has to be funded in that way. And indeed, many programmes like that, they bring money back into the BBC. You know, the big dirty secret about the BBC is that much of it is extremely commercial and is selling programmes funded by the taxpayer in 150 countries, and the money is not actually coming back to the taxpayer or to the revenue or helping to fund the National Health Service. So it's
funding the BBC, though, Edwina. It's funding the BBC.
In which case, why bother with all the rest of it? Why bother with all the paraphernalia of chasing people and a licence fee, or even thinking about changing it to taxation? You know, we need our taxation revenue to do other things that matter to all of us. Everybody listening here, we need the taxation revenue to be funding the police. We need it to be funding the health service. We need it to be funding care services. We need it to be funding education. Far more important, in my view.
Malachy?
Well, I mean, that's true as well, you know, but I mean, as far as taxation is concerned, we're all paying tax for things that we wouldn't want, you know. Not all of us agree with everything that tax is paid for. If I had my way, I wouldn't pay the bit of tax that funds nuclear weapons, for instance. So there will be people in the future under a taxation system who won't even watch the BBC and will be paying tax, whether it's through VAT or income tax or whatever, that will go to the funding of the BBC. And they will argue that there's an injustice there, but that's how it is for everybody with everything. As for the future of the BBC in a kind of wide free market, I agree also, you know, that, you know, the licence fee payers shouldn't necessarily be paying for Strictly Come Dancing. What I see at the heart of public service broadcasting is sound, dependable news and analysis. And it wouldn't bother me too much if the BBC retracted back into basically that kind of service, and specifically, I suppose, very much as well at local level through local stations, the things that you have there. But I mean, we don't need the BBC for high quality drama anymore. I mean, we have had it, and it's been fantastic, but we are getting it also from Netflix. We're getting it from Prime. We're getting it from Disney. The Disney that did the big Say Nothing series, for instance, or Disney Plus, rather. Mm. So fundamentally, my idea is that we need the best possible journalism and the best possible news service. And true it is that, you know, as Edwina says, Channel 4 does that, and Channel 4 does it sometimes even better than the BBC does it. And that's true. And we get commercial outfits like The New Yorker and The Economist, which also produce very, very fine authoritative journalism. But I still think that where you're in a situation where the market influences you, or where you're subjected to advertising, then you're going to get a tilting of the news in concession
to the demands of advertisers. And I've seen that in the press.
So, Malachy, I mean, that argument would carry more weight if it wasn't for the fact that certainly on this side of the pond, local news programmes, local news coverage by the BBC has been cut back dramatically. Lots and lots of the smaller local news stations, especially local radio stations, simply vanished. And instead, what the BBC has done is an awful lot of virtue signalling by creating a whole new department of fact checkers, 60 fact checkers. In my humble opinion, those 60 fact checkers would be far better at local level, going out in the streets and in the hillsides and talking to local people and getting the facts as they actually occur. That would be a far better use. But it's not what the BBC is doing with our money.
Robert's on the line. Sorry, Malachy, let's go to the calls.
Sorry, go ahead, Mark. Yeah.
Robert and Temple Patrick, join the debate.
Good morning. Yes, absolutely. Lisa Nandy, who in my opinion should have been the leader of the Labour Party and would certainly have made a better job than the current occupant, is going in the right direction, and eventually she will have to come to the conclusion that she will have to fund the broadcaster from taxpayers, because the elderly people who sadly pass away will not be there to pay the licence, and the younger people will not be interested in it, and they can get whatever information they want from all other sources, which I don't really know anything about. And also, by the way, when paying the license, you have to pay the license to watch, for example, ITV or whatever. And of course, none of that money in the license fee, to my knowledge, goes to ITV or the commercial channels. And also, of course, a government which obviously, on reflection, must have been Tory, went back on their commitment to make license free for over 75s. Nothing new, of course, about Tories going back on their commitments, or for that matter, Labour. And also the other issue is the amount of money that the government spends on foreign aid to finance and support dictators and questionable countries
right,
where they persecute Christians and so forth and so on, is obscene as well.
Robert,
they'd be better putting the money into the licence fee.
Yeah, the big go at our politicians. We have a retired politician, though she's always going to be a politician, Edwina Curry, on the line.
No, she's not. No, she's not. I don't know why she's on the programme.
Oh.
She's got nothing to do with Northern Ireland. She was rejected by the electors of East Derbyshire
or wherever she was. We invited her on, and we're very happy to have her on.
Of course you did. I know you do. My question is, of course, that's self-evident, my friend. The fact of the matter is, why do you invite a failed politician from the Tory party?
Edwina!
Who never represented Northern Ireland, never got a vote in Northern Ireland, when your programme is 99% listened to by taxpayers, ratepayers and licensed payers of Northern Ireland.
Robert, over to Edwina.
The reason you have me on is I really get up the noses of people like that and they phone in. That's why you have me on. I have opinions that are worth listening to. I'm one of those older people that had a free license fee for a while and then had to start paying it again. I'm content with that. It seems to me that in many ways our pensioners are the people who use the license fee most of all and benefit from it. I think your call has just demonstrated also the truth of what Malachy said earlier, that, you know, one person's extravagance is another person's necessity. And we all have different views on how the tax money should be spent. That said, the fact is that we have a growing older population. We have a growing need for the health service and for other services that older people use to be well funded. Mm. And that money should not be going to be paying for the BBC.
Also, if you had to be elected to public office to appear in a programme, I would never have been in any programme.
We should make that a rule for the rest of the week. No, we won't. Edwina, I think the common ground, if there is any, between you and Robert is the fact that both of you would agree that the BBC licence fee and the future funding of the BBC is very, very political. What do you think? We know what you want to happen next. What do you think will happen in 2027?
Oh, dear. That, I mean, if it if it didn't require to happen, if there wasn't a real issue about renewing the charter, I think the answer would be nothing would happen. And that's what's been going on for a very, very long time, that this has been kicked into the long grass by politicians and governments of every political persuasion. It's something they'd rather not deal with. But in a way, the tremendous success, and let's recognise this because a lot of the programming is made in Britain, the tremendous success of Netflix, of Amazon, and the open access of YouTube and Facebook and so on, that is putting the BBC into a very old-fashioned kind of concept that we need a government or a state broadcaster of some kind in order to preserve the quality of news broadcasting. I don't think that's true any longer. I don't think it's sustainable. And I think Lisa Nandy is going to have to do some changes.
But does it not bother you also, Edwina, that there is so much nonsense now spoken of this, you know, that what I mean, the coiner of the term fake news, Donald Trump, is the major generator of fake news. There is a load of fake news out there. There's a load of nonsense talked all the time. There's opinions that are ludicrous being aired on social media and even in mainstream media. There's a loss of faith in the BBC. I mean, I hear the most sensible seeming people saying they don't believe the BBC because it's all propaganda, which I don't believe at all. But do you not think that somehow we have to have some kind of attraction back to a space, a ground that can be held and determined to be authoritative and dependable? You know, if it's a total free market with unrestrained, with no restraint on comment, on analysis and all kinds of ludicrous ideas splashing about the place from people like Elon Musk, who seems to think that King Charles can dissolve Parliament.
Steady, you know? Steady.
Yeah, well,
Maliki, you've just opened another can of worms.
It's the same subject in a way. It's part of the argument for public service.
Maliki, thank you. Thank you to Edwina. We're going to return to that. That's an issue that's not going to go away. As we know, the BBC, I dare say, will be opening up those negotiations with the government in the coming days, weeks and months, if those negotiations haven't started already. Anyway, here's another question. How old is too old to still be living with your parents? According to new research, the number of young adults still living at home across the UK has risen by almost 500,000 over the past two decades. The study was done by the Institute of Fiscal Studies, so it's a proper survey, and it suggests that the proportion of young adults living with parents here in Northern Ireland grew from 21% to 23%. So it's happening here. Why are young people still taking up residence at the hotel of mum and dad, and why are they doing it more often? Well, I've been speaking to the student, Dermot Hamill, and the Belfast Telegraph night editor, John Laverty. Like many of us, John was still living at home in his early 20s.
Morgan, it was convenient. I mean, I at that time, my parents lived in Ballymena, and I was working for the local Ballymena paper, which was just round the corner. It suited me just fine. I think I knew I had to move out eventually, but in the 2 to 3 years where I worked in that newspaper, I saved a lot of money by not renting a flat or renting a house or buying a house. And but after that, for the next 40 years, I was either renting or owning a house, and I never went back to it. I didn't become part of the boomerang generation, as they call them, who move away from their folks and then a few years later move back. That which is obviously increasing quite a lot these days.
And John, when you were living at home but working, were you paying into the house?
Yes, but it wasn't direct. It wasn't like a direct dividend. it was when it suited me, really. You know, parents are like that. I mean, they don't actually ask. Well, occasionally they might ask for something, but you know, it's a sort of a general rule that we, you know, if I had a few pounds spare, I would push it their way.
Dermot, what's your situation been like in terms of living at home?
Once I finished school, I went to university in Belfast, so I think the longest I've spent at home really since growing up was, I think, a month at Christmas time. Like, I haven't really been in back at home other than occasionally at the weekend. And I work in a bar down home now, so I stay at my parents' place on the weekends, but that's really the height of it.
And do you contribute to their domestic economy?
I did whenever I stayed for summer. I think there was a month, 2 years ago, where I stayed for a wee while. And I did for, I think, the couple of weeks that I was here, but nothing kind of crazy, to be honest.
And Dermot, as the younger person, is there still a bit of a stigma within students, within young people, within those in their 20s about living at home?
I don't know if stigma is the right word, but I think that there's a general feeling that we don't want to, if you get me. I come from South Armagh, so kind of anybody who didn't really go to university, up until about 25, plus sometimes later, usually do live at home. And I mean, had I not went to university, I probably would be living at home fully. So down here, there very much isn't. It's kind of, it's the dumb thing, and everybody does it. In terms of my colleagues at university and stuff, the idea of going back to home after you graduate is kind of worst case scenario, nightmare situation. But I think it's more so just due to the freedom that comes with having been moved out, you know, doing the kind of boomerang generation thing. It's a weird thing, and I don't think people enjoy it.
John, the big difference for you and I compared to when we were growing up, I didn't even have a TV in my own bedroom. Now, with people's devices, you could live at home and barely see anybody else.
That is true, but it's not natural, Mark. I mean, when you get to your mid-20s and heading towards your mid-30s, you really have to be away from your parents. That's the natural order of things. Now, unfortunately, the cost of living these days has moved everything around. And, you know, people are, there are people who enjoy the hotel of mum and dad and the bank of mum and dad. I enjoyed it myself for a while, and because it only goes one direction normally. But there are a lot of people who are living with mum and dad at the minute in their mid-20s because they have to, because financially it's just beyond them to do anything else. I mean, the cost of housing, you know, is one thing. And here especially, Mark, I mean, you're reading all every month that the cost of housing in Northern Ireland is shooting up. It's going back to the you know, pre-2008 times. And if I was a young person in my early 20s now, starting off in the property ladder, I'm not sure I could get onto the first rung. Really. Mm. And I think that people are, you know, either reluctantly going back to stay with their parents, or having to do it. I think there's a small percentage who actually just want to do it and thinking this is great, you know, rent free accommodation. But it's just not the natural order of things in my book.
Dermot, I can't see you, but I can feel you nodding your head in agreement.
Yeah, I the idea of kind of like I came home to my parents' place for Christmas. And I mean, especially because it's in rural Armagh, like I've gotten used to in Belfast, I can order a pizza at 3 a.m. And no one will so much as look at me funny. If I like got up at kind of any time past 10 o'clock in the evening and decided that I was going to make myself a sandwich, I'd get funny looks. you know, I think like it is just kind of astronomical, the costs now. I mean, I pay for a flat, there's three of us in it, and we pay £400 a month each, plus bills. And it's not like I'm living in a nice house. It's a really rough apartment. And it's only going up from there. We're looking at next year, you're looking at £450, £500 a piece each month. And you're kind of going, what's it for? You know, the cost of, like the idea of getting on with the property ladder in 2, 3, 5 years' time whenever I graduate, it doesn't seem realistic. It kind of seems like a pipe dream, and I don't really expect it to happen to me.
John, you make the point that people do it in terms of needs must, but what about the kind of Walton's theory that, you know, families should stick together if you've got a big enough house, even when they get married, everybody under the same roof?
Call it Christmas every day, eh? I don't think it works that way. I think that with adults, even related adults altogether, there's always going to be tensions. There's always going to be, you know, who's the big daddy, so to speak, in the household, and I would not recommend that. I mean, I was away briefly when I was a student, away from home. I came back out of necessity, but in the back of my mind the whole time was, although I love my parents very much, but I need to get out of here. I need to be independent. And I mean, it's the vast majority of people go that way, and I think the Waltons is a bit of a romantic Midwest thing that I don't think people should be moving towards.
Again, I can't see Dermot, but I can see him scratching his head, I imagine, going, who on earth are the Waltons?
Yeah, that's a reference that predates me, I think. I think I have seen it kind of on my uncle's television in his house.
But you know the idea, Dermot, you fall in love and then you and your other half come home into the family home and you all live happily ever after.
I can think of nothing worse.
But Mark, who owns houses like that in Northern Ireland?
I could think of bringing home a partner and living with them in my parents' house. The sheer idea of it sounds awful.
Try that in a terraced house in the Shankill.
But some have to, John. I mean, the serious point is some have to. We're back to what the point
well, exactly.
that you two guys were making. They have no other option.
Yeah, I mean, and it's getting worse. I mean, according to these figures, it is getting worse, and I'm not sure. I mean, more social housing possibly is one of the answers to this, but it all boils down eventually to the housing situation and the cost of housing and the property ladder. And until you know the interest rates start coming down more dramatically than they have been, it's going to stay that way, Mark.
Quick question before we go for the over 50s: can you name three of the Waltons? Come on, quickly, three of the Waltons. I'll give you five: Mary Ellen, Ben, Jim Bob, Elizabeth, and of course, John Boy. It's now time for Connor Boy. It's time for Connor Boy Phillips. I'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for all your calls. Thanks for all your texts. Thanks for your company. I'm here all week.
The biggest show in the country. Listen again on BBC Sounds. Tweet at Stephen Nolan. Stephen Nolan Show.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like the secret that's there. I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice, and for other people to not be hurt, for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.